You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where the only thing oppressive about math is how terrible I am at it. Seriously, if white people are supposed to be better at math, why did I not get the white privilege for that? I just didn't get the white privilege that time. And also, if math is more individualistic, why are Asians, who have a very collectivistic culture, the best at it? If you think about these things when you see memes on the internet, then you have found yourself in the right place. I am your host, Justin M. Lesneski, and why don't you tell your friends who have the same thoughts to join us? And joining me this trip, from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards.
Oh boy, I'm so excited to be joining you this week. No farce whatsoever, only serious news, considered by serious people, for serious reasons. So, thank you.
Also joining us, from Dale's lawn, identifying as a woman to forego his white male gay privilege, William Green.
Hello. Well, Justin, I think it's because you only recently received your white privilege, because I've been seeing a lot of people criticizing the president for talking about more open immigration from Poland and how that's racist. I've been trying to explain to a Twitter troll how that was a double bind. See, if Trump opens it to Poland, then he's racist because it's pro-white. But if he tries to close or make it harder to emigrate from Poland, then he's also racist because Polish people are typically considered Slavic by the white nationalists, which is separate and distinct from the traditional white national thing. But no one seems to get that.
That's a great point. I'm glad you pointed that out. Thank you. The other thing I love about that story that you shared with me, William, is the idea that by the transitive property of leftist logic, the Polish people are now Nazis, yeah. Which is like incredibly fucked up.
I'm only entertaining this troll because I find it so obvious a double bind that it's just funny to me. Every time he doesn't see he or she or it or they doesn't see
or
that, that this premise is that Trump is racist, therefore every action is explained by that racism, right? And if you really want a more rational immigration policy, which I'm definitely one of those people, we should be encouraging open and free immigration from a, you know, intelligent and peaceful country. That would be great. We want more Polish people over here. Give us your best folks and send them over here, please.
Give us your tired, your Poles, your hungry.
What I really want to know is, where does the Auschwitz Twitter account weigh in on this? They're pretty active, unnecessarily. They must have an opinion on this.
I don't know. Oh God. I didn't sign up to talk about this much Polish stuff, so.
we'll get back to white topics then.
Thank you.
We'll get back to the topics Daniel really cares about, because I included the first news story for him. Let's do it in the news with Daniel T. Richards.
It really is that bad. These aren't harmless criminals. This isn't just a fad.
But before we get to the news, let me take one moment to point out our Patreon account, patreon.com/themidside. Patreon's a platform where you, our loyal listeners, can go and give us a couple dollars every time we produce a piece of content. It helps us keep the lights on. You know what else helps us keep the lights on? Nuclear power, or at least it could if we want to reach our net zero carbon dioxide emission promise that's being thrown around by the Democratic field. The problem is we'd have to build a whole hell of a lot of nuclear plants in order to meet this promise. Let me set this up for you a little bit. So there's been this concept of net zero carbon emissions by a given future point. And the Democratic candidates for president have been essentially bidding on that point in what some people are calling an auction of promises, in which the politicians vie to outbid each other with proposed emissions targets that are simply not achievable. For instance, Joe Biden committed to achieving net zero carbon dioxide emissions by 2050. Not to be outdone, Andrew Yang bid 2049. Cory Booker, in a bold stand, took 2045. And Bernie Sanders, not to be outdone, said he wanted a 71% reduction by 2030. So here's the problem with that. In order to get anywhere near these net zero carbon emissions promises...
Daniel?
Yes, sir.
I bid a dollar.
You bid one net zero carbon emissions by year one?
Yeah, I bid a dollar.
Okay.
Why is it the Price is Right? All right, continue.
It is kind of funny, isn't it? The problem is to reach these things by achieving net zero carbon emissions requires the building of plants that don't give off carbon and, of course, decommissioning fossil fuel plants that do give off carbon. And really our only hope of that, guys, is by building nuclear power plants, because those are the highest energy density sources of energy that we have that could do this the quickest. But here comes the problem. To reach by 2050, which is the furthest date, mind you, that one of the candidates is offering, we'd have to build one new nuclear power plant every single day, starting 6 days ago. So we're already behind, guys, just letting you know. Justin, what is with the bidding? Is it just virtue signaling of a certain kind?
Well, I don't even think it's virtue signaling. I mean, it's just like the Bernie Sanders, we're going to give everyone free education. It's just campaign promises. I mean, where's that wall, Daniel? Where is the wall? And I ask because this is what they do, right? We're ramping up into the season where they make all these promises that they're never going to get make good on just because they want to get elected. I mean, can you imagine, like, if this happened in any other thing? Imagine you were going in for a job interview and you just made all these promises and they hired you and then you didn't fulfill on those promises, but they kept you around anyway. And they say, oh, that's just what people say in job interviews. The only thing I've seen that's kind of like this is in dating, where supposedly, you don't really see who people are for the first 2 to 3 months. They pretend to be someone else. They put their best foot forward for 2 to 3 months. That's the only thing where I've seen where it's kind of like that. But of course, that creates toxic relationships. That's why we're in a toxic relationship with the government in this country, because we just accept this. We're just like, oh, that's just what people say to get elected.
That is what people say to get elected. William, turning a little more science-y to you, since you're the science guy on this show.
Just don't call me Bill.
Oh, I would never. Will Nye, the science guy? Okay. No. So on the science side of things, we can either build one nuclear power plant every day for the next so many years, starting 6 days ago, or if you prefer, we could deploy 1,500 wind turbines over 300 square miles every single day. So pick your poison.
My God, isn't fossil fuels important? that's the real takeaway here, isn't it?
A little bit.
You know, it's funny because nuclear power is great and we need lots and lots more of it. But just with the sort of electrophysics side of things, nuclear power makes a great base load. You need the power system is very complex, and nuclear power is not easily or as easily ramped up and down. So, but it is incredibly efficient when running within a specified range. So you want to have a good, 50-60% base load be something like that, like nuclear power. Coal also makes a good base load, which is why we use it. But then you need natural gas to deal with the hour to hour, minute to minute, sometimes differences in the draws of power. This idea that nuclear power can solve this issue is just as insane as saying let's all switch to windmills. Maybe not just; it's a little less insane since nuclear power works and wind power doesn't. But
Key distinction.
Yeah, but it's just as insane to decide a priori that the way is nuclear power and not look at the way it's done now and understand why it's done that way. But I want to move a little bit after this. So go ahead and ask, but I want to move a little bit into these promises.
Oh, good. That's where I'm going. So I'm transitioning into.
Can I ask a question first?
No.
Really? Both of you at the same time? No, I have a more fundamental question. Where did this myth come from that we need zero net carbon emissions? Is it some sort of emissions natural for the life cycle of the planet?
Well, we need net zero because so first the first step on this horrible argument that I don't agree with, but the first step is that we need to stop emitting carbon, and then the next step after that is we need to start taking carbon out of the air. So, but if we continue to add carbon, it will basically just get harder and harder for us to take it out of the air before we hit the doomsday scenario that Greta Thunberg and others are warning us about. So that's why you start hearing about this.
But don't we need some carbon in the air?
Yeah, but we need the perfect number as determined by the International Climate Body and a cadre of scientists who clearly have no self-interest in pursuing this science except that to save humanity. So we need the perfect number, and the number we have now is too high, and we need to bring it down.
So it's 12, then. 12 is the perfect number.
42.
What?
Are we bidding, or what?
No, I figured Tom Brady's number has to be the perfect number, so it's got to be 12.
Yes. What is the number is like... is it 350, William? Is that where the 350.org stuff comes in?
It's funny because I was watching something, and of course it had all this. It was PBS Eons, which looks at ancient animals and things like that. They're talking about different geological ages and how they tried to directly tie carbon dioxide to changes in climate, which is a precarious thing to do. Because a lot of those systems are pretty well intertwined. Like when you look on geological scales, we've had much higher atmospheric carbon dioxide and then also much colder temperatures while having that higher carbon dioxide. This is something that that Alex Epstein points out all the time. Also, the fact that you increase carbon dioxide up to a certain amount and the greenhouse effect doesn't, like if you double the amount of carbon dioxide, you don't get double the greenhouse effect. It's a law of diminishing returns. There's a lot of complex things going on. And much of the Earth's climate has to do with where the tectonic plates are, was the takeaway I was taking away from the video, the way they explained it, and not the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which was pretty hilarious and probably the opposite thing that I was supposed to draw from that video. But I wanted to get to the promises here. One of the things I've been noticing is we talked about a bidding war, but all these Democratic candidates are just promising more and more and more in order to sort of out-promise each other. I looked around and I could not find this. I spent about 30 minutes looking yesterday, and I'd love for someone to join Discord on just go to themidside.com, click on the current episode and join our Discord, and show me a list of all the campaign promises from each of the Democratic candidates. I think Elizabeth Warren has the most things to do on day one that I've ever seen of any presidential candidate. She's going to stop drilling. She's going to end offshore drilling. She's going to stop mining on federal lands. She's going to ban members of Congress from trading stocks. Like, there's this huge list of things she's going to do on day one. She's going to have a very, very busy day on day one as Emperor of America.
My question with all this is, so there's certainly a scientific illiteracy that plays into promising net zero carbon emissions by 2050, but there is this. So going back to like a chicken in every pot and a car in every garage or whatever the campaign promises were, which were
sort of a rice cooker in every kitchen, although that's
outlandish in their day, but sort of measurable and sort of constrained. To fast forward to, we're not going to be basically using fossil fuels by the year 2050. which is, well, it's not only literally impossible without massive war and death, it's also not desirable. My question is, the detachment from reality, how far are voters going to be willing to take it? Do you think that this is still just the beginning of the detachment from reality, total detachment, I mean? Are we going to eventually just hear politicians? I mean, they're already talking about a universal basic income, but why not just, I'll make you all trillionaires by the year 2021?
So I think you have my vote. Could you do that on day one, though?
Day one, I will print enough money to make you all trillionaires by the end of my inaugural speech.
Man.
Now, but my question seriously is, at what point is there some backlash here? At what point do people start to go, I get it, this is a lie, so I'm not going to vote for this person? Or is there? Is it a never-ending, do we never hit peak political promise, Justin?
This is something I have difficulty with, Daniel, because I don't know the level of ignorance that's out there. The sort of willful evasion of reality due to emotionalism. Because these promises are just, they're things that sound good and they make people feel good. And they make people feel like they're personally being helped or they're personally helping other people via electing these candidates. So I don't know, I don't know where it would be, because I don't know the level of ignorance that's actually out there. I mean, to me, building the wall and having Mexico pay for it was one of those promises.
Course. Yes, but absolutely.
But it got a lot of people to rally behind it, rally around it. They didn't rally under it or climb over it. It seems like we're already there, and I don't know if there's a way to go back. And this is one of the greatest questions I have about this culture in general, because it just seems to be emotionalism at its core is the issue.
I think it is emotionalism, and I think we haven't seen anywhere near peak political promise because we haven't seen anywhere near peak political emotionalism, right? So you could, if you wanted to be reductio ad Hitlerum, go back and say that the political promises that Hitler made to the people about his country and their place in the world were worse than the political promises that are made here. But the question is that an inevitability then? Do we have to head down a road of total authoritarianism because the promises will get worse and worse and because the politicians will have to deliver in some way to keep the people in line? Now, that's a pretty dark question, so I don't know if either of you want to address it or evade it.
I mean, I think that that's just the logical implication of all of this. I mean, I think that's what the left has been trying to stoke, and I think that's the bandwagon the right jumped on. That's not the way the left says the right is becoming authoritarian, but I think that that's what the left has been going for years. The idea that if we make everything subjective and we make everything emotional, well, that gives us basically carte blanche as a government to do whatever we want, which gives us all the power. I mean, when you start using these slogans that have words hope, change, great in them, these are undefined terms. They become floating abstractions. And these floating abstractions have different concretes in everyone's head, which gives the government carte blanche to do whatever it wants. So I think logically it has to go in that direction. So I don't see the question as particularly dark. I just see it as shining a light on what needs to be shined a light on. That's just reality to me.
Well, I don't know if it's a slow march or a quick jog, but we are on our way to authoritarianism. Emperor Warren is not too far off, William, with the number of things that she claims the government has dominion over. It's pretty frightening. And we'll see. We'll get into a little more of that frighteningness in the final story of the news section. But before we get there, there's a different kind of frightening, which is a different kind of ignorance than what we were talking about earlier, which is that there's a new Tide Pod, everyone. Yes, kids are now getting sick from eating vaping cartridges full of liquid nicotine. Now, at least in this case, it doesn't appear to be a challenge or something that's internet driven, but simply bad parenting. So doctors in Kansas are sounding the alarm over a vaping-related trend where young children get a hold of their parents' devices and consume whole cartridges of liquid nicotine. Dr. Stephen Thornton, medical director at the University of Kansas Health System Poison Control Center, said, "We've had kids eat the cartridges, drink the solutions, and get sick. Parents are calling saying, 'Hey, I found my kid holding the vaping product,' or 'I found the kid with the e-cigarette pod in their mouth.'" Which leads me to ask the question, what the hell are the parents doing? At least 16 Americans with a history of smoking e-cigarettes have died from lung injuries in a nationwide, are you ready, epidemic that sparked an investigation by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. William, what was that?
How many?
16.
16 deaths.
For 16 vaping. Deaths.
Do you know how many smoking deaths there are a year?
How dare you?
How dare you? This is an epidemic. 480,000.
This is an epidemic.
16 is an epidemic?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
There is an epidemic of regular season football games in this country.
Thank you, Justin.
Wow.
Over 800 non-fatal lung illnesses have been linked to vaping, although a recent study actually claims that none of these illnesses or deaths can be tied back to actually manufactured vaping pods, but homemade ones. So
800. So the stat that's always claimed for second, third, fourth, and fifth hand smoke is like under, like between 8,000 and 30,000 causing disease, not death, but disease. So, and we had to, you know, ban smoking from all public places for 8,000. So now we're down to 16. So if 16 people die and 800 people get sick, then we must regulate.
That's right.
How many pogo stick deaths are there a year? I bet it's more than 8.
Someone Google that. Someone Google that. In the meantime, Justin, we don't need to ban vaping, but can we ban parents from vaping who let their kids eat nicotine pods?
I mean, I think this is an improvement. As a culture, I mean, Tide Pods, you get no value out of eating them. It's just you're eating poison. But with nicotine, at least there's like a little bit of a buzz or something, right? So the kids are getting better. They're getting smarter about what chemicals they're ingesting. I mean, we're
maybe
improving.
It's a ADHD treatment, self-medicating.
Yeah. I mean, this is ultimately an issue of parenting. But I think you guys are touching on the more interesting issue here is this question may be controversial to some out there. And I mean, if somehow a leftist stumbles on our podcast and listens to this question, how many deaths are acceptable? And what I mean by that, hold your brakes, your social justice warrior who's listening to it. Well, that's where I was going with this, right? Like, isn't there just the reality of life that somebody's going to walk down the street and fall into a manhole and die? So does that mean we have to ban all sewers and manholes? So what is the number?
Ban walking, duh.
Yeah, we have to ban walking, right? You can only walk when it's approved by the government.
Also, zay holes, but yes.
Sorry. I didn't mean to, social justice warrior listening, I didn't mean to have a microaggression there. I apologize.
You gendered the cover of a sewer.
I didn't gender it. The patriarchy did in the past, okay? I was just repeating that because I had internalized it without realizing it. It's so easy to talk like this, isn't it? I could do a whole show like this.
Cover outside of my house, and he's transitioning and prefers to be called a she now.
We should do a whole episode, like for April Fool's next year, where we just do the social justice version, the bizarro version of this podcast. But no, William, do you remember back on Star Trek, they always used to be like, one death. If there's even one death, it's unacceptable. So they had to like go back to the planet and like endanger every life on the ship because somebody did something stupid. And it was, you know, we couldn't let that one person die because we can't let one person die. Isn't there the reality of life that people
that
are going to die in
that
fucked
was
up
the
ways?
Quaint, Justin, that was the quaint old left where the as mixed up and wrong as it was valuing the individual. We don't do that anymore. That's not a thing. It's that women are and minorities are hardest hit by this kids sticking their parents' vape pen in their mouth. That women and minorities must be hardest hit, which is why we're hearing about this.
Isn't this the fault of the patriarchy because they've so internalized it that they have to stick phallic symbols in their mouth?
Oh, God.
How do you know
that?
Save
it for the April Fool's episode, Justin.
As a woman.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Women have penises now.
I shouldn't judge the symbolic shape of genitals to be the symbol of the gender. I'm sorry.
So, bringing it back to something interesting to the audience.
This is very interesting.
What is the... Someone explain to me the obsession with the regulation of vaping. I get it with cigarettes. They are objectively dangerous. I still don't think the government should be as involved as they are, but I do get it to some degree. I don't get it with vaping. When the worst you can bring out is 16 people and 800 injuries, that it pales in comparison to any number of things that are less regulated than this. And of course, the quintessential example that everyone brings up other than cigarettes is alcohol, which is insanely dangerous it is regulated, but far less regulated than vaping is. So someone explain to me the obsession.
I have a theory, and William, who actually vapes, can follow up on it afterwards and give his opinion. But what I think it is it has to do with keeping power, where basically no one could smoke anymore, so we invented vaping as a way around this rule of not smoking, and that makes the people who said you can't smoke look weak, because it's like, oh wow, that's unhealthy, and it's disgusting to smoke. Oh well, here's a way of smoking that's a lot healthier and doesn't hurt anyone. And if they let that go, it's sort of like, well, they figured out a way to beat us. And they can't beat us. We're the government. We're unstoppable. We're perfect. So I think it's a way of, they're just, it makes them look bad to have vaping out there.
William, thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's about control. They had this, 14% of Americans smoke or something like that, some weird stat like that. They were able to control these 14% of Americans that smoke, and now they've lost that control. And, they were expanding it with second, third, and fourth hand smoke, but now they can't expand that anymore because, you know, if people switch to vaping, you have those people with the super big mods blowing giant puffs of smoke, but you can do it and almost be undetectable with it, right? Getting back to these kids, some of them smell good, which is why I think they're putting them in their mouth, but I don't... vape juice is disgusting, so I can't imagine how these kids are drinking it. They're probably chewing on it. It busts, and then it gets some in their mouth, which is too much for a kid. It'd be too much for anyone, by the way, because it is concentrated. But it seems really weird. I have a friend, longtime friend, sometime listener of the show, so I won't mention his name, who grew up on a tobacco farm, and he talks about how one morning he went out. Well, his uncle, I think, owned the tobacco farm. And one day he went out and he thought he would be resourceful and have more day in his afternoon if he went out early and started picking the tobacco. But that was a huge mistake because the dew was still on the leaves, and he ended up, that transferred a bunch of nicotine to his skin. And of course he got very, very sick, like nausea and that sort of stuff. So to me, it's just funny. Yeah, kids and nicotine is a thing that has happened in the past, by the way, back in the day when people used to live on farms. So,
yeah, when we had labor with our kids.
Yeah, that's true.
In that story, I heard that we should ban dew.
Oh, yeah, that's what I heard. We should ban rain.
Yeah. So speaking of things that people are upset about and want to control, I guess, I don't know, Kansas University is apologizing for a controversial late-night performance by none other than Snoop Dogg. The University of Kansas issued an apology after some fans gave the show a mixed review. This comes after the rapper Snoop Dogg brought out strippers, used a fake gun to shoot money with his face, which I don't understand that sentence, and used profanity during the performance. Late Night is a KU preseason tradition that happens every season at Allen Fieldhouse with skits from the basketball team, performances by the KU pep band, and high-profile performers. Director of Athletics Jeff Long says the school asked for a family-friendly version of Snoop Dogg's typical performance and apologized for the incident. He said, quote, "We apologize to anyone who's offended by the Snoop Dogg performance at Late Night. We made it clear to the entertainers' managers that we expected a clean version of the show and took additional steps to communicate to our fans, including moving the artist to the final act of the evening to ensure that no basketball activities would be missed if anyone did not want to stay for his show. I take full responsibility for not thoroughly vetting all the details of the performance, especially the strippers." No, he didn't say that. "And offer my personal apology to those who were offended. We strive to create a family atmosphere at Kansas and fell short of that this evening." Hoo boy. Justin, they strive for a family atmosphere at Kansas and invited Snoop Dogg for that. Do you expect this was the clean version of his show?
That's funny. I wasn't thinking that, but that's really funny. I don't think there is more than one version of Snoop Dogg. Like, I think they asked Snoop Dogg and they were like, "Can you do a clean version?" And he was just like perplexed. He was so high that he didn't understand what they were asking. He'd be like, what do you mean? I'm Snoop Dogg. And they're like, "Can you do the clean version of Snoop Dogg?" He's like, "I'm Snoop Dogg. Like,
I'm gonna shower before the show."
I don't understand. This is like Disney is not addressing Deadpool right now for this reason, right? Because people are like, is Disney going to do a PG-13 version of Deadpool now? No, Deadpool's R, or there's no Deadpool. Like, it's the same thing here. The thing that blows my mind is you want a family-friendly thing, and then you're like, we want a family-friendly performer. Let's do Snoop Dogg. Like, who else was on the list?
Well, he did have multiple appearances with Martha Stewart, so there is a family-friendly side of Snoop Dogg, I guess.
Did Bill Burr open for him?
Like, just not one that's billed as late-night whatever, right?
Dude, Daniel, by that logic, it's like, well, Bill Burr has a show called F is for Family, so he must be family-friendly. Let's have him open.
Yeah, Bill, can you give us a clean version of your show? You'll have exactly 41 seconds of material left. William, did you have any performers like this in college? Because, and I kid you not, the pinnacle of the people who showed up at Millikan University in Decatur, Illinois, was the Smuckers Brothers. Or is that what they were called?
I don't know. I don't know about a actual like school sanctioned event. I know that I remember one of the concerts I went to on campus, but we had like a venue, like they had like performers come in. So the only show I ever got to see there though was Third Eye Blind, and I should have known by the fact that I could afford the tickets that it wasn't going to be a good show. And it was absolutely terrible. Third Eye Blind could not carry a tune. And I'm not just talking about the singer. So it was a terrible performance. But
interrupting real quick. When I was at school, I didn't think of Vanessa Carlton. Her sister went to our college, so they had her come and perform. Nobody showed up. There was like maybe 50 people in the room. And then her piano broke, so she just walked off stage and didn't come back. And I was standing there, and I was like, yeah, that's probably about right. That probably was the only outcome of this. The only possible outcome.
Yeah, I just don't remember having, I mean, maybe like Jason Mraz or something came to Millikan, but not things I was into. We got a lot of like, you know, small jazz ensembles and stuff. Like, we didn't get Snoop Dogg, but I guess we were no KU. So I was just curious if there was any crazy big acts that came through your schools, but who knows. This is just another example of Kansas being idiotic. I don't know. I mean, Kansas seems to be in our news a lot for making some bad decisions, not the least of which is to attend Kansas.
Well, I think what happened was the kids who inhaled the vape, when they were eating the vape, they then lobbied to get Snoop Dogg on the campus.
I want to know. I bet the strippers usually go full nude, and they just probably kept their tassels on. So this was the family-friendly version. I'm going back to what you said originally, Justin.
That's right. I do want to clarify. I said earlier that it was the Smuckers brothers who came to our school, and that bothered me from the moment I said it. It's actually the Smothers brothers.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. The Smuckers brothers are they make jam in front of you.
Yeah. I thought it was a delicious sounding show, but
that would have been more entertaining, honestly.
When you heard jam session, you didn't realize they would be like making like strawberry and raspberry like spread for your sandwiches. You thought it was like fish was going to show up, but then you got people making jelly.
The Smothers Brothers are dad humor, but from the 1950s. So just to put that in context.
Was there at least one hipster laughing?
I think there was a bunch of 90-year-olds laughing.
Oh, man.
Or dying.
So the show
was
for the alumni. Anyway, moving on from the past.
Yes, moving on from the past into the future. The future where free speech is killing us, according to a very hot opinion piece by the New York Times that made the rounds this week all over the social medias by Andrew Marantz, who's a New Yorker staff writer and the author of the forthcoming book Antisocial. So I don't know exactly how you guys want to dive into this, because this is one of those rare stories where I could read a sentence and we could talk for about 45 minutes, because it is a bullion cube of terrible. Like, it's just so concentrated in its shittiness that we could just dissect every bit of it. So it starts like this, everyone. Prepare yourselves. Here's the opening sentence to something in the New York Times. There has never been a bright line between word and deed. Period.
That's all you need to read in this article, by the way. I'm serious. There's nothing else you need to read in this article. This summarizes the left's view on hate speech exactly, precisely.
I have never read a more ignorant sentence in a major newspaper in my adult life. They let him publish this and are not embarrassed by it. One more time, there has never been a bright line between word and deed. Justin, if I say, I'm going to murder you, or if I take a knife and slit your throat, is there a bright line between those two things?
No, they mean exactly the same thing. Because I had to imagine
that's what his sentence
would imply.
When I was
imagining you murdering me, when you said you're going to murder me, I had to imagine that. And that created a great emotional distress and trauma on my part, because I had to imagine you killing me. That's much worse, because I have to live with that. When you slit my throat,
you ended up literally dead, right?
Right, that's worse than me being literally dead. Because when I'm dead, I'm dead. That's it, I'm dead. There's nothing I can do. But I have to live with that in my head forever because you said that. What the fuck is wrong with you?
Let's use a less depressing example. How about I say the words, a pile of $1 million bills. Or I just hand you an actual pile of $1 million bills. Is there a bright line between those two things?
Yes, because when I have the $1 million... I am instantly become corrupt and I'm a terrible person because money is the root of all evil. But when you tell me I'm going to give you $1 million, I get happy and I have all this hope that I live with because the idea that I'm going to get $1 million is in front of me. So there's no difference there.
We should call what you're doing now, instead of yes and, we should call it yes Antifa. You're just turning everything into a social justice nonsense tirade.
It's funny though, isn't it?
It's something. It's raising my blood pressure. Okay.
There are probably walking by in front of me carrying a giant houseplant for no reason. So
they're probably random. There are probably 800 or so more words to this article, and I literally don't know. I could spin the wheel of words and point to any random sentence, and we could talk about it for 45 minutes.
Well, that's because let's talk about the why, though. The why is because each one is an equivocation. And this is just a long series of equivocations. I would encourage people to read this article with that in mind. There's so much equivocation between, there's so many examples, like one from like Rwanda, one from, obviously, we have to use Christchurch, we have to use Charlottesville, all these equivocations, and the blame is always put on the free speech, and that the free speech it directly causes the action, and therefore we should take all that justice we want to fire against the actual perpetrators of these crimes and instead place it on 8chan or whoever else was the platform that had this speech. But I want to get into the most important thing about this article is that it was beautifully parodied by the Babylon Bee. Same exact headline, free speech is killing us, written, of course, by Kim Jong-un. So, noxious speech is causing tangible harm to the best country on earth, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Yes, this fact implies a question so uncomfortable that many of us go to great lengths to avoid asking it. Namely, what should we, the government, private companies also owned by the government, or the happy citizens of the republic be doing about it? The answer is obvious. We should have thought police. We should crush free speech so we can preserve order and stability and a stable society and a benevolent government. We should curb speech in an effort to stop violence. Violence is a real problem and a consequence of free speech. Can you imagine if people just say whatever they wanted? You'd have people mistrusting government. You might even start a violent revolution that overthrows the government. May dear leader forbid it. Using free speech as a cop-out is intellectually dishonest and morally bankrupt. Yes, free speech is a glorious pastime of our wonderful, prosperous empire, but it's not the only one. It must be held in tension with other values, such as equality, safety, good citizen, worshipping me, and stamping out anyone who'd we be foolish enough to speak up against our utopia. Look, I'm not calling for repealing free speech entirely. What I am arguing for is silencing those whose speech your majestic rulers, namely me, find to be potentially seditious. Only when speech is carefully policed, with your betters determining what can be said and cannot be said, can speech truly be free.
Wait. How much did Babylon Bee pay you to read that on air, and why have I not gotten a cut of that?
I just thought that's the perfect summary. Instead of these 10,000 words, that's the perfect summary of this op-ed.
It really is, and not to add really anything to that, but you should go now and read the original article, Free Speech is Killing Us, in the New York Times, and see how much they... I won't use the word plagiarized, because it's definitely satire, but how much they basically took directly from that, not the least of which is this ignorant author's discussion of values and how there are other values that are hold in tension with free speech, like equality, safety, and robust democratic participation. Safety. Did you know that, William, is a major bedrock American value?
Yeah, safety.
Which is why we... threw off.
It's like the Zeroth Amendment, right?
Yes, the Zeroth Amendment.
Well, and that's one of the intellectually dishonest things the author does in the article, where he's like, well, I don't know if it's a man or not. Sorry for assuming the gender. But he's like, yeah, you're not allowed to yell fire in a crowded theater, therefore we already don't have free speech.
Yeah, it's one of the most ignorant straw men. And again, the offensive thing about this to me is not that this argument is being made, it's that it's being made in the New York Times. This argument is made all the time on people's personal blogs.blogspot.noonesgonnaReadthis.com because that's where this ignorant nonsense belongs. But to elevate this kind of thinking into the most prestigious pages of opinion in the country, the pages that receive more competition for entry than any other of any other news source, to pick this article above other things and say, this is what we want to put, especially in our Sunday review, is an abdication of the New York Times responsibility as a journalistic organization that at some point in its career had integrity. I know it doesn't now, but there is some remnant of respect that it should have for itself not to publish such trash.
All right. Speaking of having some sort of integrity and producing trash, let's talk about that in The Hopeful Romantic with JML.
to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. I need a rerun to better cast the next series of events. In the air timeline lapse, my made-for-TV type was written off in the last season when I wasn't focused on.
As always, if you would like to continue this conversation during the week, you can join our Discord channel. William already plugged it. You go to themidside.com or themidside.com/podcast and click on an episode. And inside that episode, there's a link to joining our Discord. You can maybe talk more about what Daniel said right there about that article. And the reason, Daniel, that I sped through the transition from what you said is I think that was just the perfect way to sum it up. And I think it's the perfect way to lead into my review this week. So the world is on fire right now. And I don't mean that literally, although it's kind of ironic that it is, because Joker, the movie starring Joaquin Phoenix, the origin story of the Batman supervillain, is making what, 95 plus million this weekend. This movie is written and directed by Todd Phillips, who's done War Dogs, if you remember that movie. He did the Hangover trilogy. He did Due Date. He did School for Scoundrels. And he did, famously, what the two things that got him started were, which this is really actually interesting, were Road Trip and Old School. And did you know, Daniel, the first three movies he did before that were documentaries he directed?
No. Interesting.
So he directed a documentary about Fish, the band. So that wasn't about, you know, making jelly. That was actually a jam band. And then he did Road Trip in Old School. Now, when you hear that filmography, Daniel, William, does that immediately make you think this guy should do a serious look at the Joker's origin story?
Only if he is a minority or transitioning.
Does he have a brother who both want to become women?
Are you asking if he's related to the Wachowskis?
I'm just saying it puts him in the running for doing big
or
things.
Or dating one of the Wachowskis.
I don't think he would, but no, he's just a regular old straight white male.
Boring. So, no.
No, and the reason why. Why, when you look at that list of movies, what do you think? What do you think of that person's capacity, especially intellectually?
Yeah, fair to middling? I don't know. I mean, he could be fine, but it's not demonstrated through that filmography.
Okay, that's my point, right? So when you hear about this movie, right, and you hear about all this controversy about it, what I want you to think about for a second is, this is written and directed by the guy who did the Hangover trilogy, who got started by doing Road Trip in Old School. And that's pretty much what you get out of this movie, right? So in the trailers, it looks naturalistic, right? And he said to Joaquin Phoenix, he was like, you know, let's smuggle in a real movie under the comic book genre. And he is attempting to do that. But imagine that guy who did Road Trip, who did Old School and the Hangover trilogy, trying to do that type of movie. And that's what you get. Look, the acting is phenomenal. You cannot fault Joaquin Phoenix. He's doing everything he can in this movie. The cinematography is good. The score is excellent. But when you try and dig into this movie and you try and find some side of a point in it, you can't, because it's so internally self-contradictory that it doesn't make any sense. And what I mean by that is, Daniel, you've heard people on both sides attacking and praising this movie, correct? On the left and the right?
Yeah, it's one, it's a cinematic Rorschach test, it seems.
Right, because you can read whatever you want into it. You can read this as being pro-Antifa. You can read this as being so extreme that it's a parody of naturalism. You could read it in that way. But also, if you're extreme alt-right in the extreme sense, then you could also read this as, well, here's a white man, a straight white man who's been oppressed by the system, and this is his way of fighting back against it. You can read all of these things into this movie because it's so internally self-contradictory. Now, there is an argument to be made that the whole thing's in the Joker's head and it's all from his perception, and that's why it's so unreal. But that's part of what makes it self-contradictory. Because if it's in his head, is the point to be sympathetic towards him? Or is the point to have a cautionary tale? Well, the end of the movie doesn't really give you any way of looking at it that way. And then, perhaps the most egregious thing of all in this movie is they redo the Batman origin story. And what I mean by that is...
Really?
Yes. That was my reaction. Because they're trying to make some sort of bullshit intellectual point, and it just falls flat. So... In the movie, he's like, what, about 35, 40? Right? Joaquin Phoenix is 44 in real life, but I think he's supposed to be like 35. So I'm going to say he's 35. We're going to estimate that. And what happens is he lives with his mother, and his mother is always writing letters to Thomas Wayne because she is convinced that he is Thomas Wayne's son, that she worked for Wayne Enterprises and she had an affair with Thomas Wayne and Thomas Wayne disowned him and he's Thomas Wayne's son. So he goes to the fucking Wayne Manor and he confronts little Bruce Wayne, who's like 6 to 8 years old. Then at the end of the movie, when there's all this anarchy going on, you see the theater and it looks very similar to the theater from, you know, The Dark Knight Rises or from Batman versus Superman, to the point that I leaned over to Christine and I was like, oh, this is a reference to the Batman origin story. And then they fucking come out of the theater and I go, no, they're not doing this. So I'm sitting there and I'm thinking this is just like a cutesy reference to the Batman mythos, and they come out and I'm in disbelief. And then all these people in clown masks are running around the city to protest how evil the rich are. And one of them follows they go down the alley, right? That was what happened. So my girlfriend goes, yeah, Christine goes, don't they get killed in an alley? And then they walk down an alley and I go, fuck this. The guy in a clown mask follows them and just shoots them for being rich. You even see the pearls get ripped off. And if you want to see the difference between, you know, how Zack Snyder directs something and why he makes it beautiful versus an attempt at naturalism, watch this. And it just... compare those two pearl shots and you'll see the difference between somebody with ability and somebody without, and romanticism and naturalism. But the idea that they've remade the Batman origin story and it's all the Joker is the one who caused Batman to become Batman really has a level of, like, I can't even wrap my head around that. And then you factor that in, that the idea that this could all be in the Joker's head. So the Joker imagined his own nemesis being created by himself. None of this makes any sense. And the fact that everyone is like either blowing this movie as like the greatest movie ever or complaining about it as if it's so terrible and it's a threat, that is equally reifying this movie, equally making this movie as more important than it actually is. This is just a 2-bit movie made by a 2-bit director who happened to get a good star and a good cinematographer and a good actor to work with him because he's proven to make bank at the box office. That's all this is. It's not even really worth, like, it's not even really worth being like, this is disgusting in the way a Darren Aronofsky film is disgusting. It's just sort of like, this exists, and the worst thing about it is people talking about it as if it's this epic thing when it's not.
So it'll get an Oscar?
I don't even know if it'll get an Oscar, because the reason the incel comments are coming is in the movie, he sees this beautiful woman living next door to him, and he seems to be having a relationship with her. But you find out later in the movie that was all in his head. So that's why they're calling him an incel, because he lives at home with his mother. He stalks this woman at a certain point, and then he imagines a relationship with her and wanders into her apartment at one night. So it's literally naturalism for straight white men. And I think there is an element of the left that's angry about that because you can't apply that to white men. So I think there's a racist element backlashing against this movie. But again, it's missing the point, right? Everyone's missing the point because they're looking at this on the surface level and they're seeing what they want from the movie. So you should see this movie if you just want to know what the fuck is going on and you're curious as to what everyone's talking about. That's really the only reason to watch this movie. Otherwise, just go watch Breaking Bad. If you want to watch someone become evil and why someone becomes evil and what it means to become evil and what happens to them when they become evil, just watch Breaking Bad. You shouldn't watch this movie if you have anything else to do with your time. Honestly, whatever that project is you've been putting off, if you need to go repaint the garage, go repaint the fucking garage. That'll be more productive, okay? Let's move on. As always, I post the trailers for Trailer Takedown on Saturday morning at the latest on the website. You can go there, themidside.com or themidside.com/podcast. You can watch the trailers before the episode. You can watch it during the episode, or you can watch it after the episode, or during the episode, you can, you know, pause and alternate between our takes and the trailers so you know what's coming.
Trailer Takedown. First trailer.
The Gentleman is Guy Ritchie's latest movie. It has a very high-profile cast. It's got Matthew McConaughey, Colin Farrell, Hugh Grant, and they all look excellent in this movie. It looks like a cool action-type movie like Guy Ritchie always does. And then for me, there was a disappointing reveal that this is all centered on the marijuana business. And maybe it's just me, but I have trouble getting into movies where they're like, yeah, there's all this stuff going on. It's super important. All these actors are awesome, but it's all about drugs. And I'm just like, everyone in this movie is shit at this point. I don't care about any of them because it's like they're fighting over something that's bad for everyone. So as good as this looks, as good of a director as Guy Ritchie is, he's generally made enjoyable films. I personally, this just doesn't appeal to me, and maybe that's just a personal issue, so I'm really interested in what Daniel and William have to say. Tackle.
Tackle.
Do you have the same reaction to movies about alcohol?
Yeah, but there aren't as many movies that are blatantly about, like, oh, alcohol, blah, blah, blah. I had a hard time with Boardwalk Empire for that reason, where it was like, oh, wow, we're fighting against the oppressive government who's stopping us from doing something that kills us. Oh no. Now again, I don't think alcohol should be illegal, but like there are better stories to tell.
Okay, so I don't have that reaction because I don't care about that side of things. My reaction was I thought Hugh Grant was Tom Cruise for about half the trailer, so I just didn't particularly get into it. I think it looks unbelievably good, and I do want to. This seems to be an original story, so in many ways, I do want to give it a chance. So I think the best I can do on this is like a Netflix and hug.
Netflix and hug.
William?
See, always the sophisticated, interesting businessman is always doing something evil, so I had a similar reaction to you, Justin, on that. But this looks interesting. I think there'd be some good acting and some good cinematography in here, so I think I'll give this one a chance.
Hug?
I thought you would also react positively.
Second trailer.
Okay. I thought you would also react positively to the amount of guns in that trailer.
Well, there's another one coming up with guns.
I think there's a couple that are coming up with guns. So second trailer, Six Underground is Michael Bay's latest effort. It's on Netflix. It stars Ryan Reynolds, and it's about six people who are forced to go underground to have some sort of a caper. So it's sort of like the Fast and the Furious, except it stars Ryan Reynolds and doesn't look as cheesy in the way it's directed. I love Ryan Reynolds. Michael Bay is fun. This is on Netflix, and I appreciate them bankrolling this kind of stuff. And there's something I learned by going to IMDb. Dave Franco is in this movie. Weird. Hug.
Hug.
We need a Dave Franco and hug one for Justin. So Michael Bay is fine. It's sort of visual candy kind of storytelling that I'm not all that into. Ryan Reynolds is fine. But what the hell is this about? Anyone? Bueller? Could someone tell me what the plot is after watching the trailer? Other than Ryan Reynolds kills people? No. This is something my wife is into, but this is not a me thing. Tackle.
Tackle.
We've got Ryan Reynolds, we've got guns, we've got kicking people off of buildings. Definitely gonna watch this.
Netflix and hug.
So the description here is on IMDb: meet a new kind of action hero. Six untraceable agents, totally off the grid. They've buried their past so they can change the future. Which also tells you nothing.
Nothing. I got nothing out of that.
Third trailer.
Birds of Prey is the quasi-sequel to Suicide Squad, starring Margot Robbie as Harley Quinn, where she allies with a bunch of other female superheroes to do something. I have no idea what they do, but Margot Robbie is great as Harley Quinn. I mean, she was one of the best things of the Suicide Squad movie. She's one of the best actresses out there. This looks interesting visually. It looks different. This looks like it would be fun. They seem to be positioning Harley Quinn as the DC version of Deadpool. So I see no reason that I would not want to see this unless I was just sick of comic book movies. Hug.
Hug.
Speaking of being sick of comic book movies, Tackle. No thanks.
Tackle.
Yeah, this looks like social justice in the DC universe. I think I'll pass on this one. Tackle.
Final trailer.
Richard Jewell is the latest movie coming out from Clint Eastwood. In it, he tells the true story. And I thought that was really interesting when that came up, where it was like, the true story of Richard Jewell, the man who prevented one of the bombings at the 90, was it 96 or 94?
I think 96.
96 Atlanta Olympics, where he found a bomb and he told people about it, and they were able to prevent the bomb from blowing up. And then he got accused of being the bomber. Now,
well,
what was really
white.
Interesting... What?
He is white.
Well, yeah, they went after him because he was a straight white man in 1996. I didn't know we were doing that yet. But what was interesting to me was I was watching this and I didn't know what it was. The trailer came on before Joker and Jon Hamm was there. I was like, anytime Jon Hamm is in a movie because he makes such excellent script choices that I'm just interested in it. And then it was like Jon Hamm. And then it was like in the latest film from Clint Eastwood. And I was like, Jon Hamm in a Clint Eastwood movie? Wow. And then this looked great to me. I mean, the way to really experience how it affected he's just a normal average guy. He's not smart. He's not super able. He was just a normal average guy doing his job, trying to do the right thing. And seeing this destroy him and him not being capable of handling it because this kind of situation is not supposed to happen to someone like him. I think this movie is going to be tremendous. Hug.
Hug.
Yeah, agree with all of that. This looks superb from storytelling, from theme, from acting, directing. There seem to be no flaws in this trailer. I do want to point out explicitly that this is yet again Clint Eastwood telling a story about sort of how government F's things up, right? How there's a dark side to what they do, and it's not innocuous, that they can destroy people's lives for seemingly no reason except to make themselves look good. So, power to you, Clint. Keep producing them, man. Hug.
Hug.
I agree with everything everyone said. My only reservation is sometimes I wonder about films like this. This falls in that category of would I rather watch a documentary or watch a dramatization. But in this case, I'm intrigued, so I too will hug it.
Hug.
I would agree with you, William, if it was any other director besides Clint Eastwood or Zack Snyder or maybe Christopher Nolan. Yeah. I just think those people are the ones who are capable of handling this sort of material. And Daniel, do you think it's just about government or it's also about how media fucks things up too?
Oh, the media's absolutely indicted in this. It's all around. It's a culture bash.
All right, well, I think that sums up what we have to say about the trailers. I think William is going to say goodbye right now. But William, if you could do us the honors of just hitting one last drop as we head into Belichick, your premises.
Go talk to the geniuses that are online.
Still scream.
Recorded live during week 5 of the NFL season, it's time to Belichick Your Premises. And this is really a Belichick Your Premises episode now that we got rid of William there, huh? Now that we kicked him out.
That's right. Screw that girl.
That was a good callback. So this is week 5, and I looked at the slate of, we're recording this episode on Sunday, we're releasing it on Monday, so this is midday. It's in the middle of the second slate of games, so if anything happens after we talk about this that's different from what we said, that's, you know why. But I looked at the games this morning, Daniel, and I thought this slate of games this week was pretty shitty.
Well, since this is rational sports talk, why don't you explore that? What made this week not a compelling schedule?
Okay, well, there's two things. First of all, the matchups, none of them were particularly interesting. But then I think there's a more overall point, and we can get into this with the Patriots in particular. I don't think there are any teams that are like wow worthy this year. So when you have like teams that are like average looking playing teams that are terrible, then it's just not interesting. I mean, let's see what we had. We had Jaguars, Panthers. They're 2-3 and 3-2 now. Cardinals, Bengals, Falcons, Texans, Buccaneers, Saints. Okay, the Saints are 4-1 there, but the Bucs were coming off of the big win last week, so maybe that was a decent game. Vikings, Giants, Bears, Raiders. I'm looking at all these records, and besides like the couple 0-4 teams, most of these teams are average teams.
Yeah, I think the two best games of the weekend are actually tonight and Monday night. So Colts at Kansas City and Browns at San Francisco. And I think you're right. If those are the two best games of the week, that's saying something. So here's the question for you, Justin. Has the league finally reached parity that they've been going for? They've been trying to balance out these teams so that more teams win more often, or maybe to put it differently, so that it's not, you know, Patriots domination. It's more even-handed so that more people share. The wealth is redistributed, if you will. Or is there something else going on?
That's a really tough answer. I do think they're moving towards the parity, but I also think there's issues of officiating, and there's also issues of player development. I think right now, as far as player development, there is a lack of star power at the quarterback position. Besides Mahomes,
You're not on the Gardner Minshew train.
Can someone explain that to? Can you explain that to me?
Like I saw an article today that said he's the next Tom Brady.
They lost today. They're 2-3.
But his mustache, Justin, glorious mustache.
Yeah, I've seen him as a meme, but I haven't seen or heard of him doing anything impressive. I'm trying to click through to the stats today to see what his stats were.
No,
maybe he was good in a loss.
He looks good. He looks talented, but he looks very unrefined.
374 and 2 touchdowns.
Yeah. But he looks good. He's made some difficult plays, right? So that's why he's getting a lot of praise. Whether or not he's the next Tom Brady is, we'll say that the jury's out on that one, at the least, but... So is there anyone you've been particularly impressed with this season, team-wise, player-wise, coach-wise, etc.?
I mean, I think I'm surprised by Brissett. I think he's been playing well as a starting quarterback when there was some questions of whether he was starting caliber or backup. So even though they're 2-2, I think he's done pretty decent. Baker Mayfield seems to be making the leap into a long-term starting quarterback, which is nice. There have been some Rams players Seahawks players who have done well. I'm just looking through the games today. I mean, Tyler Lockett sort of has come out of nowhere. Kyler Murray looks like he could be good, even though they're 1-3 and 1. They tied a game, apparently.
Yeah, I essentially agree with all those. I think the interesting thing is that even the teams who are doing particularly well, teams who are maybe even undefeated still, like the Patriots, it's early enough in the season that it doesn't appear to be it appears to be anyone's league to win at this point. So the question you had proposed for Belichick Your Premises is this, quote, "Is the Patriots team really that good?" End quote. So, are they?
Well, speaking of teams that aren't really that good, before we get into that, do you see that Green Bay is kicking the crap out of the Cowboys right now? So last
Cowboys
week...
Cowboys, who looked unbeatable a couple weeks ago.
Right, last week that was your... It's halftime of that game. And last week, your little quip at the end of the episode was the Cowboys were scary in the NFC, but after losing to the Saints last week and getting their butt kicked right now by the Packers, it doesn't look like that. So...
Yeah, I get to shift my team every week in the NFC as we play round robin with that conference to the Seahawks, who pulled off a brilliant victory against the Rams this week. And it's one of those things where you can't underemphasize determination and a sort of, it's sort of intangible or qualitative. It's an ability to find a way to win. Right? The Patriots have this, and that's why they've been so successful. Their victories don't often look like what some of the Chiefs' victories have looked like in recent years. But they find a way to win, even in situations where they're underperforming. And I think that's what the Seahawks so far are doing this year, and I think that's what the Patriots so far are doing this year. And
yeah,
many others.
I think saying that that's what the Patriots do perfectly sums up at least the offensive side of the ball. I think the defense on the Patriots is phenomenal. I'm waiting to see them tested against a real offense in the sense of like the Chiefs. Now, the Chiefs don't have a defense as it is, so that game might be pretty close because of that, where the strengths and weaknesses will cancel each other out. But I'm waiting to see them play a better team because they do have phenomenal stats right now, but they pass the eye test, as the announcers love saying. And it's they make the big plays and then they're in the right place. I've only seen them make one bad play in 5 weeks, Daniel, and it was the 65-yard touchdown run by the Washington Redskins in the first quarter, where four guys were closing in on the defender, and they were all like, oh, you're going to tackle him, right? You're going to tackle him. You got this tackle, right? And they let him run for 65 yards. And that's the only thing the Redskins did all game. So even though these teams are bad, they're still making these phenomenal plays. And I have to wonder, are they going to continue to make those plays? Or is, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm watching the game today and I'm thinking, am I just going to have to be like, okay, you know, oh, they're playing the Chiefs, I'm going to have to accept they're going to give up some big plays. Whereas now it's like, if they give up any big play, I freak out and I'm like, come on, we're better than that. Blah, blah, blah. But as far as what the weaknesses of the team are, I think the offensive line is very, very weak. And I think it's hurting the team overall. It wasn't until the second half of the game this week that they finally got a running game going. And because they couldn't run the ball, they could defend the pass more easily. And I think that's where, you know, Brady looked bad for a game and a half, game four and then the first half against the Redskins.
I think when you say someone's offensive line looks weak, it's too vague. So the question is, what is the weakness? What is it about it that makes it weak? And so there's a couple things. One is it could just be injuries, right? The Patriots have dealt with a lot of injuries on the offensive line, including season-ending injuries for players they thought were going to be their main starters. So maybe it's not that they're weak. I think my diagnosis might be that they're still inexperienced, that they're still gelling as an offensive line, and that even within games, you see it get better within the game. So I'm hoping that will translate over the season so that they are a formidable offensive line, assuming that the injuries don't continue, which you can't assume, I guess.
Yeah, your point about the injuries is well taken. I mean, the starting center went out for the season with a lung infection. The left tackle is on injured reserve right now. And the thing you said about adapting in-game is something that's very interesting, because offensive linemen tend to be the more intelligent players because they need to know the plays completely, and they need to know how to block on the plays, and they need to know all the defensive plays and how to adapt with the defenders, and not only how they could adapt, but how the linemen next to them could adapt. So I think some of what you're seeing is adapting during the game is the coaching adapting and the players just doing what they're told, rather than if you look at the part of the reason the defense is so good this year is Hightower and Collins both know how to read the plays properly, and they're sort of like coaches on the field. And then you've got McCourty in the secondary, right, and Gilmore. So you've got all these players that can adapt on the field in the way that the coaches can adapt. We have a very young offensive line that can't adapt in that way. So the play that's called is the play they run, and they run it as it's called, which makes a lot of the blocking difficult. And that's why I think that they're struggling in blocking for the run game, because they don't adapt when they see the players move around, or someone, you know, throws a different rush at them than they expected on that run play. They sort of get screwed out of it.
And that seems to be, maybe this is going beyond football and into thinking about coaching teams and being a leader, but I think the first thing you need to get someone to do is sort of the basics of what it is they're supposed to be doing, I think. And then once they understand the basics of what they're supposed to be doing, you give them leeway for adaptability, and part of their job becomes anticipating new situations. But this is an offensive line that seems to be young and still inexperienced, so perhaps the thinking is, let's get them doing the things they're supposed to be doing, and then throughout the game we'll unleash them to do other things, or they'll learn to do other things throughout the game. So hopefully that means they'll get better over the season, because I don't think they've been abysmal. They've given Brady enough time to be effective, if not enough time to be totally dominant.
Well, right, but that's part of the time issue, is with the secondary being able to cover the receivers better. It doesn't matter how much time you give Brady. If the receivers aren't open, he gets sacked. And most of the sacks have not been blocking issues. They've been Brady has taken too much time because there's nobody open.
Yeah, and that has to do with wide receivers and running routes and any number of other things. So part of what I'll ask is, we don't do Super Bowl prediction stuff on the show necessarily, because we don't like to do nonsensical types of futuristic weirdness. But what I'll say is, do you see a team developing that has the elements it takes to make a Super Bowl run? That's what I'll say.
Based on what you just said, if the offensive line can continue to develop and gel, then I do think there's the potential. The only other thing that worries me is the kicking game, because, you know, their kicker, Steven Gostkowski, is on injured reserve, and then they again missed an extra point with the new kicker, Mike Nugent, and then he also hit the upright and it went in for another kick. But those kind of things can hurt you in the playoffs. And of course, we as Patriots fans, I'm getting texts from my friend who's week 5. He goes, oh my god, our kicker's gonna hurt us in the playoffs. It's like, it's week 5, bro. Calm down.
Playoffs.
I sent him that gif. I sent him that gif because we were losing 7-6 at that point, and he missed the kick. And I sent him the playoff gif, and then under it I put, it hurt us in week 5. Like, let's chill out for a second. So I do think if they develop, then in the way you said, then yeah, there is huge potential there. And I do think the arc is there, and I do think that's how Belichick coaches, that the whole team is like that. Because remember, it's only the first week of October. So if going into November, the offensive line looks better and the run blocking is better, I think it'll be fine. Because as far as pass protection, I think you're right. Let's contrast this with an offensive line like the Texans. Isn't the Texans' offensive line bad because they're not even able to stop opposing rushes at all? And Deshaun Watson?
The Texans have an offensive line?
Okay, exactly my point.
Pretty sure it's a direct snap to Watson, who then gets tackled.
Right. He either throws the ball quickly, or he runs away, or he gets tackled. And so I think there's a difference, right? I think what you're trying to tease out here is the problems the Patriots have on the offensive line is not physical, technical capabilities on an individual level. You're saying it's as a unit.
Yes. And I think that's fixable over a season, assuming the injury rate stays down. But in a particular moment or in a particular quarter or even in as much as a game, it could be detrimental. So far, it hasn't been detrimental enough to lose the game, but it has been difficult to adjust to.
Isn't the Cowboys offensive line kind of ironic in that way? Because the Cowboys offensive line, I think, is the best technically. Like, they're big. They can really protect Prescott. But they don't always execute that well.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So
So for
pick your poison.
You, if you've ever wanted say hot that, offensive line talk.
Yes. I know that's what you tune in for here on the Midside. Last thing I'll say is I've done a week. So this past week I was at a leadership retreat. So I'm thinking in these silly leadership and strategic terms. But the term that comes to me about the defense here is the concept of lead measures, which is types of measurements that can indicate the outcome that you want. And one of the lead measures, I think, of this defense to be on track as one of the all-time great defenses is looking at interceptions and takeaways coming into the game with the Redskins, Justin. Coming into the game, the team had 11 interceptions in four games. 11. Did you see how many the second team, the best defense, had in four games?
No.
Did you see that number?
I did not.
It was 5.
Do you know who 5. It was?
I don't know who it was, but it was 5. That is a strong indicator that this defense is on track to do things we've not seen a defense do in a very long time in the NFL. The other staggering lead measure that I saw was that even including this game, including the Redskins game, they have yet to allow a passing touchdown this season. And in fact, they've only allowed 2 offensive touchdowns, right? The other 2 touchdowns came off of special teams plays.
Yes.
So no passing touchdowns.
The idea that even against bad teams, you cannot give up a passing touchdown in today's NFL is insane.
It's not even conceivable, really. I mean, other than watching them having done it, you couldn't. That's a Madden type of stat. Like a Madden foot, like the game type of stat is what I'm talking about. So those 2 things together, I think, are incredible lead indicators that this defense is on track to be one of the best of the best. Assuming, again, no major injuries. But
did you know that every week, Daniel, they've had a McCourty intercept the football?
That's another good stat. It's funny to me that you have to say a McCourty. Yeah.
Well, that's why I said it like that, because the first Devin McCourty set a record, right, for doing 4 in a row for the first month of the season, you know, one every game. And then this week it was Jason McCourty. Because the reason I said that is there in the announcer said, like, McCourty intercepts the ball. And I was like, which one? And then I saw it was number 30 and it was Jason. And I immediately came up with that joke. I was surprised the announcers didn't say that.
Yes, that's a good time. So, so moving forward. We've talked about the Patriots. We want to give an update on anyone you think is frightening to the Patriots. I know you started this whole thing saying that football looks miserable this year, but so let's rule out the NFC. Who in the AFC looks dangerous so far?
I mean, it's the Chiefs. It's only the Chiefs.
Hmm. Only the Chiefs?
Yeah, I mean, Your vaunted Browns barely beat the Steelers today and have looked imminently beatable. They turned back into a pumpkin finally.
They didn't play the Steelers today.
Yeah, they did. Oh, sorry. The Ravens. Your vaunted Ravens.
Oh, the Ravens.
Yeah, okay. Sorry.
Yeah. So I think the thing about the Ravens is they're one of those, what's the word? They have a puncher's chance every single game because of their weird...
Yeah.
Strategy and they're insanely athletic and intelligent to not create a false dichotomy quarterback. So they're not as frightening as they looked in the first couple weeks, but I still think they're one of the teams that could beat the Patriots. I think the Chiefs are the other only because Mahomes is next level, to use another phrase I've heard all week. Is that it?
I mean, I think we played another one of the really good teams. I mean, the Bills are now 4-1, and they're 3-0 on the road. Like, I don't think anyone should sleep on the Bills.
Yeah.
I think they have a legitimate defense. I think they have one of the best defenses in the league.
Yeah, that's right. If their quarterback can get a little bit more accurate or something, I'm not sure what he's missing exactly. I haven't watched him enough, but they could be scary. So,
can we talk about fantasy for a second? Can I rant
you
about fantasy?
Talk about fantasy football? Who are you?
Well, I just want to make a point as to why I don't like fantasy football, okay? I'm about to make a point. Do you want to know how many points my team has right now? 153. How many points do you think my opponent has?
I hope it's 154.
189!
When you lose with 153 points, that has to hurt.
Lose by, what is that, 36 points?
That's hilarious.
Look, my
Are you
quarter,
done? Do you have no more players going, or do you still have a chance here?
I have two players playing right now, and one of them already has 25 points. Aaron Jones already has two touchdowns. Look, Deshaun Watson has 43 points. Aaron Jones is 25. Sonny Michel, 19. Josh Gordon, 8. Tyler Lockett, 14. Jimmy Graham, 4, and he's playing right now. Larry Fitzgerald, 8. Greg Zuerlein, 11. My defense, 17. Like, when do you hear that lineup and you lose?
It's a rare day.
This is why I don't like fantasy football. Let me look at the rest of the... How can I look at the scoreboard for the entire league? I bet you I would beat almost every other team. Yeah, that other game, your game is 92-66. Fuck you. Another game, 91-63. Another game, 83-130. I would literally win any other game this week. Like, are you kidding me?
Yep.
This is why I hate fantasy football.
Oh, Justin, I love hearing your rants about fantasy football. It reminds me of our days of playing Mario Kart.
Sitting well, it's not my fault! Everybody
about the blue
just gets
shell.
The blue fucking shell!
Here comes the communist shell.
Still fucking shit! Jesus.
Yeah.
All right, I think that'll do it, right? That's enough?
That's enough.
All right.
My face, your face, instant face. Go talk to whoever you want that does that stuff.
What did we learn this episode, Daniel?
I learned that KU, apparently there's some people there who are pretty high to have invited Snoop Dogg to a family fun performance night. So don't send your kids to Kansas, ladies and gentlemen. Justin, what did you learn?
I learned that if we change Bill Nye's first name to Douchebag, he becomes D-Nye the Science Guy.
And that's all you need to learn, ladies and gentlemen. But if you had anything else, tell us on all the social medias at The Midside. Go to themidside.com/podcast. Listen to all the past episodes of the show. Catch up with years, literally years, of us talking. You can go to themidside.com/store. Pick up your Midside merch. And follow links over to Apple Podcasts and Google Play, where you leave us 5, not 4, not 3, not even 1, but 5 stars, and helps us move up the ladder there. Patreon.com/TheMidside. Thank you so much to our Patreon subscribers. We sincerely thank you for helping us pay for things like hosting and microphones and stuff that helps us sound good and present to the world. You are the best. You can go to patreon.com/themidside and become a Patreon subscriber today.
You also help pay for therapy.
That's right. Really? Is there a therapy fund?
Well, it helps me sound good to the world. I think that's valid.
Yeah. So, train of thought totally derailed, which is normal. Thanks to Liberty.me for syndicating us. Thanks to our liberty-minded libertarian listeners. And tell a friend. Telling a friend about the show is the number one way your friends find out about the show. And it really has helped us grow throughout the years, which we want to continue to do so that we can bring you more social justice criticism and good art criticism as well. So until next time, we love you.
This concludes your journey into The Midside. I'm Justin and Emma Zeski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a free speech day. Is that it? Not going to say anything? Are we done?
Well, I don't have anything for the music now. For the blurb after. Do you have anything for the blurb?
Blurb.
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 Blurb. Outro.
Blurb.
Capper. Blurb. Easter egg.